You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
My name is Matthew Iglesias. I'm the business and economics correspondent for Slate. And I'm very excited to be here at the Brookings Institution moderating this panel. Title is How Do Government Restrictions Harm International Online Trade and Commerce, which is obviously a huge, huge SEO term for me all the time. And I've been asked to say that the a hashtag for this event is TechCTI, if you have anything to say on Twitter. And also, if anyone is watching on a webcast, can weigh in there. And good questions may even come to the fore here. On the panel with me is Joshua Meltzer, a fellow here at Brookings, Stanford McCoy from the Office of the U.S. Trade Representative, Jake Colvin from the National Foreign Trade Council, Alan Friedman, also from Brookings, and Jonathan McHale, also from the USTR office. It should be a great panel to help sort of explore these questions. And I thought maybe just sort of get started in with things and turn to Joshua here, whose paper is the sort of occasion for this event, I believe. And, you know, the Internet it's sort of experienced by most people as this sort of formless, you know, very free flow of information thing. It's a miracle of communication. You can reach out to anyone, anywhere on the planet at any time. But obviously it is on some level a series of physical infrastructure that exists in particular places and that governments want to regulate because activities happen places, facilities are located in different places. And so there can be a lot of tension there between the sort of open global possibilities of the Internet and the reality of governments sort of trying to do their legitimate regulation and also, though, trying to create sort of protectionist trade barriers. Can you maybe just set the table for us a little bit, talk about what's the sort of key issues here that people need to understand?
Thanks, Matt. And thank you, everyone, for making it out in this rainy weather. From my perspective, when we think about the Internet and its role in commerce, I mean, one of the focuses, I think, has been on the role of, we can think about e-commerce, we think about the role of e-commerce domestically in the United States, in North America, and how that has grown over time. I think one of the new phenomena we're seeing is the Internet increasingly being a platform for both global international trade. And importantly, and as a very key complement to that, has been the significance of cross-border data flows or the free flow of information is also a facilitator of international trade. In fact, I might refer to a couple of numbers quickly just to highlight this point. One of them is the number of 30%, which is actually the number of internet revenues captured in the United States. The next number is 60%, which is the difference, the digital divide which currently exists between internet access in the developed world and in the developing world, and 600%, which is in fact the potential growth in cloud-based computing export services, which we could see out to 2015. Now, I mention these figures simply to highlight a couple of salient facts. One of them is the potential and the economic significance for the United States. The other is the potential growth of this in the developing world. And the other is the way that all this comes together as a very important platform for international trade, including the role in this context of cross-border data flows. Now, as Matt pointed out, and I'll just say this very briefly, I think we're at a point in time where the capacity of the Internet to drive international trade is really still in its early stages. Yet we're also at a time where we are seeing an increasing propensity around the world for forms of intervention and restrictions in the Internet, whether it's actually government action, various rules and regulations, which is challenging the capacity and the ability for the Internet and for cross-border data flows to deliver the type of economic potential that it can. And so the challenge, which the paper you may have picked up out the front tries to get at, is how do we develop now new rules, new regulations, which can both maintain the open nature of the Internet, which has produced the type of gains that we've seen so far and will continue to grow into the future, but at the same time, giving governments the space and the scope to do what they may need to do to address legitimate concerns in probably what we would say is the least trade restrictive means, while at the same time avoiding other concerns which are considered less legitimate.
Thank you. Now, to Stanford, what's the role of intellectual property regulation in this? You know, when you talk about the flow of data across borders, you know, that can mean many different things. One thing that it often does mean is the flow of sort of copyrighted content, other forms of intellectual property. Different countries have different regimes, different interests here. We need some kind of framework for them to trade together. How does it play out?
Yeah, sure. I think, Matthew, you could probably find people with different perspectives on this issue who'd be willing to say that that intellectual property itself was either the problem or the solution to online barriers to international trade. Neither one of it, which is probably entirely the case. I think from the perspective of someone engaged in international transactions, whether you're talking about physical goods or intangibles traded over the internet, goods, services, or something in between, you're probably looking at IP as an important background condition for transactions, a way of defining and confirming that the person who's offering something for sale or license actually owns what they're purporting to sell or license, and for a way of defining what you're buying if you engage in that transaction with them. So the stability of rules in that space is important from just a pure transactional standpoint. And I think it's probably also fair to say that intellectual property is a potential source of great complexity in international transactions and international trades, particularly as you try to map those questions about ownership and protection across multiple different jurisdictions where a particular item of intellectual property might exist simultaneously and might be more or less enforceable, more or less protected in different circumstances across those multiple different jurisdictions. So to bring it back to sort of my part in this and international trade rules affecting intellectual property, I think that where the rubber meets the road is on the question of certainty. It's like if international trade disciplines have a role to play here, it's a role of seeking to enhance certainty for people involved in international transactions. And I'll give you one example, which is around the existence of regimes like the Digital Millennium Copyright Act we have here in the United States to both define aspects of online liability for copyright infringing content and to define safe harbors so that intermediaries engaged in trade in that area will have some certainty about what kind of behavior on their part will protect them against uncertain liability. So it's in fostering that kind of certainty around IP that I would see a role for trade.
And Jake, you know, when you sort of hear about, well, internet trade, you know, your mind naturally goes to a certain set of sort of high-tech companies. But your organization represents a very sort of diverse group of American businesses, a lot of them that are outside of that sort of narrow domain. And can you tell me, I mean, what's the business interest in this subject? Why does it matter to your constituents?
Sure. Thank you, Matt. I think, you know, having the opportunity to see a perspective from many different businesses, it's clear that there are two sort of equally important challenges. And one is kind of what Josh already laid out, is the ability to participate effectively in the global digital marketplace. But the second is, you know, dealing with the consequences of that and the consequences of the explosion of digital information online. And so I don't want to minimize the challenges for businesses. And, you know, I hear this a lot from our companies, that it's certainly easier to distribute illegally software in the digital age. Trade secrets are a huge concern for our businesses. We spent quite a bit of time on this in our recent submission to USTR on IP barriers. And I know the administration just came out with a report on dealing with trade secret theft. But then there's also a whole set of concerns that aren't related to intellectual property rights. You know, companies have might get wrong-footed on privacy concerns, on, you know, morality around the world, which is sort of regulated in different ways. And so there's a role for trade policy here, I think, to effectively protect IP, which we do, for example, through free trade agreements, to provide space, international dialogues and policy frameworks to bridge gaps or differences in privacy frameworks nationally. But I think the key is doing this all in a way that is least trade restrictive as necessary, and that permits the digital economy to function, because there is a real opportunity here. And so for our companies and businesses generally, I think being able to plug into an open global digital marketplace is really important. For our companies, it's essential to the way that you do business in the modern world. And so I'll give you a couple of examples from our board membership. Procter & Gamble is a company that I think about a lot because I've got a seven-month-old at home, and so we buy a lot of Pampers. And so if you Google Pampers, they've got their own website for Pampers, Facebook page, Twitter account, YouTube channel, and Procter & Gamble now has an online web e-store where they sell directly to consumers. And so this is, you know, a major interface for Procter & Gamble into their customers, both in the United States and advertising for around the world. Now, General Electric is also on our board, and they make what they like to call intelligent power plants. And so these power plants can be monitored remotely, and they are monitored remotely from the United States, from their IQ headquarters in Atlanta. And so if you interrupt the ability of companies like Procter & Gamble or General Electric to provide these services, or the sort of the channels and the networks by which they interact with customers and other businesses, that's really detrimental to their ability to do business in the modern world. I think, you know, for us, the other reason why this is really important is because it's not only good for our companies. NFTC represents largely large companies, but because it has the potential to change the narrative in the way that we think about trade in the United States and around the world. eBay did a report last year that indicated that 97% of their commercial sellers export. And of that 97%, 80% do so to five or more markets. Now, the reason that is because eBay makes the border virtually disappear. Buyers in other countries can see a fully landed price, and when a seller goes to sell a product, he can essentially hand it off to FedEx, with whom they have a partnership with, and drop it in the mail and not worry about anything from there. I suspect I'm oversimplifying, but it's gotten a lot easier to access global markets, even as an entrepreneur or a very, very small business. And so we think that this is good for the dialogue on trade generally, and it has the opportunity not only to sort of change how we think about public policy in the United States, but also in conversations around the world in forums like the World Trade Organization. And I think on this, there's certainly a role for government policy, as Josh's paper points out. You know, we've been thinking through how to apply concepts that have governed trade in goods for decades with respect to, you know, non-discrimination and fair treatment to information and the services that provide that information. I guess I'll close by saying that, you know, Stan and Jonathan have really been really spectacular in thinking through these concepts from a public policy standpoint. And so it's been a pleasure to work with them on these issues, and I think they're really at the tip of the spear in terms of policymaking going forward and how to apply these sort of fair concepts to information. So, thank you.
Great. And Alan, you know, I think we were talking a little bit before the event about the fact that there's often a sort of clash of perspectives in the digital realm between people with a technology background and people who are maybe lawyers and policymakers in Washington. And you're more of a tech person, and I wonder if you can speak to some of that, and, you know, how it looks from a technologist's viewpoint and what it is that, you know, people need to know about how this works.
Well, I think technology can be both part of the problem and also part of the solution. So I think cryptography is a great example. So cryptography is just a technology that allows you to hide information through various means. And for a while, in this country, it was illegal to publish cryptographic algorithms to produce products. You needed a weapons license. In fact, the woman who was in charge of introducing cryptography to Windows 95 had to get licensed as an arms dealer by the United States government. And it was framed as a battle. You had the geeks who saw themselves wearing the mantle of human rights and free expression, said, listen, if we're going to communicate around the world, we need to be able to do it in a secure fashion that doesn't have eavesdropping from any government, because we don't know who to trust. And on the other side was the national security establishment that said, why do you want kidnappers and terrorists to have this stuff? And that was sort of the frame. You know, they saw cryptography as something making it harder to do their job, which was to protect us. And it turns out there was an impasse, and national security won until the late 90s, when along comes commerce and just blows them all out of the water and says, listen, we have all of this great economic growth stuff that's going to happen. This is, of course, a simplification of a long and complex discussion, but essentially commerce won the day by making both of their arguments irrelevant. We needed this stuff to make the global economy work. Now, what's interesting about crypto is we still see it. There are still export restrictions in this country about what you're allowed to send abroad, to the point where you have professors being told that non-American grad students aren't allowed to work on certain types of technology. And at the same time, what's really funny is other countries have import restrictions. So Russia or Vietnam, policies that say, listen, if you want to bring in this technology into our country, you need to clear it with the government so that we know what's going on and who has this technology. And just to close on this idea that technology can help us a little bit for things like cross-border data flows. Organizations, if they're faced with the idea that different governments are going to have different policies, can develop some tools to, using metadata or even technology that tracks specific information flows on the network individually to say, okay, well, we're going to allow certain types of data that aren't sensitive to flow around, but the stuff that we need to protect, we can actually manage that and keep it inside certain countries or out of certain countries that we care about. Now, the benefit of this is while this technology is cheap and it requires organizational change, this is also exactly the sort of thing we need to do to safeguard strategic proprietary information and trade secrets.
Great. And now, way down there. You know, I'm thinking back to sort of my college days and the basic introduction to the global trade, multilateral trade process, and, you know, the sort of graphs they show you, comparative advantage, trade is good, tariffs are bad, you have concentrated interests, so you have this process to sort of bring the barriers down, open the world up, and it's very removed from these sort of considerations that we're talking about today. How does, you know, international data flows get on that sort of agenda for the trade disciplines? What's the rationale for making this part of that multilateral trading process?
Well, I think the good news is if you look at any of the statistics, the data is flowing exponentially. You'll get different numbers for how fast it's growing, and a big part of that is international. The trade issues come in when you start seeing barriers to that. Right now it's been very difficult for governments to erect barriers, but we're at a position, I think, we're at a time where we can make sure that the regime going forward is the more rational regime. I mean, traditionally, the trade rules deal with borders. Good comes over the border. That's where you get to look at it. That's where you get to put the tariff on. That's where you get to check to see if it's safe, etc. In the service world, you know, governments have been able to license companies in their markets, and they've been able to check to see whether they're a responsible player in the marketplace. The issue here is the internet, you know, it's notoriously resistant, if not impervious, to borders. Data flows around the most efficient manners. And I think governments have a real dilemma in how do they assert their jurisdiction over their legitimate regulatory needs when they can't hold on to what they're trying to get at. So it is a new area where we are trying to deal with something that's beyond the border, where a government wants to have a role in protecting its consumers and protecting its other equities, and yet the mechanisms for doing so are not clear, and they're typically blunt. You have things like, you know, the Great Firewall of China, or you have governments just saying no data at all, and that's just a very inefficient way of being able to participate in what's obviously an enormously innovative and economically important sector. So we have to rethink this. We have to rethink what are reasonable rules that will allow governments to have an impact on what happens to data despite the fact they don't have jurisdiction over necessarily where the data is located or where the servers are. And we're trying to work through that. What we don't want, I don't know if folks can see it, but here's a picture of the what I think is the origin of the globally interconnected electronic network, which was the telegraph network. So here in 1902, 100 years ago, we actually had the first globally interconnected electronic network. The bad result of what happened in that was it started out private sector. Generally, is a lot of the U.S. and British companies doing it. Governments decided this was strategic. I'm going to control it. I'm going to nationalize it. And you ended up with a balkanized telecommunications network. 80 years later, we've essentially opened up the physical layer of these, and we have generally free trade and the ability to operate telecom networks in various markets. The data is another issue, because you can't, you know, like, governments would like to be able to grab onto this, and that sort of defeats the purpose of having data that moves efficiently and at the optimal location. And so we don't want what happened in the telecom world, which was a balkanization of who controls the various inputs. You want to have regimes that allow legitimate interests to be addressed without having both the sort of the rent seeking, where you have someone that wants just the national champion to be the player, and then that being seen as by a government as the only way that they can address their legitimate regulatory interests.
All right. You know, now moving into a little bit more discussion, I'd like to encourage anyone on the panel to jump in anytime, you know, they've got something to say. But I was hoping, actually, Jake, to revisit something you said. You sort of alluded to companies getting wrong-footed on privacy concerns, was the phrase you used. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that. I was in Germany recently and, you know, heard a lot about privacy concerns. I imagine coming from sort of the opposite direction of how American trade associations see it, and I think this is an interesting subject.
Sure. Well, and I'm not a privacy expert by any means, and so this is going to be fairly general. But I think they're just different countries treat privacy differently. They regulate it differently. My sense is that there are more stringent laws in the European Union, which sort of considers privacy a fundamental human right. But there's perhaps more enforcement in the United States and more of a patchwork of laws, regulations, and best practices that have kind of bubbled up without an overarching major, you know, main law. And so I think you do have the challenge where companies can get wrong-footed because they certainly – or they do their best to understand laws in the country in which they operate. But then they, you know, they go over and they capture information contained, you know, say they're in the United States and they want to do business in Europe. You have to understand those rules as well. And that's a difficult thing, particularly if you're operating in more than one international market. And so, you know, countries have figured out a way to try to bridge those differences. And so there's this thing called the EU-US Safe Harbor Framework that provides one option by which if you follow a set of rules that are listed on the Department of Commerce website, you are granted safe harbor from sort of, I guess, prosecution under privacy guidelines in Europe. There are other frameworks out there that have been under discussion or that have been developed. In APEC, there's a privacy framework pathfinder by which a number of countries have signed up to essentially build bridges between their different privacy regimes. And so I don't know if you guys know more about that and want to jump in on that, but that's the extent of my knowledge.
Well, I can chat a little bit. The whole trope of the EU takes privacy in much more seriously than the United States is not completely unfounded, but at the same time, I think there are a lot of cases where we have a real advantage in terms of modern regulatory thinking, and the best example of that is data breach laws, which now I think 47, 48 states have a law that says if a company has consumer data, they have personal information, which includes employee data as well, and they lose it, they have to notify the subject of the data. This first bill was passed in 2004. It's an excellent example of the political science model of the Laboratory of 50 States. California had this great idea. It soon spread around the country. And if you draw a plot of how many companies lost our data just based on public reports, it went very low, very flat, maybe 5-6 a year, and then 2004, it shoots up. Because companies now had to be held accountable for it. And this focus on outcomes of saying, listen, you screwed up, has had a number of effects. One, companies take this a lot more seriously. They're encrypting data. They're managing their resources. And we've also created a whole secondary set of market solutions. The only place where we really see functioning cyber insurance, or insurance for cybersecurity issues, is around this question of cybersecurity, is personal data breaches. The challenge of focusing on outcomes is even a law that says just look out for bad things. That should be your regulatory approach. It's hard to actually implement that from a regulatory perspective, right? If you think about a law that says, just confirm for us that everything inside your company is working properly, and if you're lying to us or if you're wrong, we're going to throw your CEO in jail. That sounds like a great policy until you realize that that's SOX, Sarbanes-Oxley. I don't think anyone really holds that up as a great model of global regulation. So we need to find ways of having accountability-based regulation inside the information space. It is easier to do auditing on a computer system, but at the same time, computer systems evolve a lot faster. So it's harder for a large organization to have an accurate understanding of what its state is at any given time.
I might just jump in here quickly because I think it's a good platform to highlight, I think, one of the challenges that we have here in terms of doing two things, which is basically making sure that we have the freest flow of data possible, but also providing opportunities for governments to do what they need to do. And you're going to get, say, around privacy, which I think is a great example, you're going to get divergent approaches, which we currently have. The US has definitely got a divergent approach to the EU, which has got a divergent approach to Australia, which has got a divergent approach to other countries. And there's a couple of ways of getting at that. I mean, in a way, to some extent, there's already trade rules on this. I mean, the GATS, the Agreement on Trade and Services, has an exception in there for privacy-related issues, but that really only applies to basically your market access commitments already made under that agreement, which is not really going to cover off where we're in the free flow of data issue, which is sort of one of the new areas which we're trying to get at. Now, you could do it in a similar way in the sense that you could basically say, you can basically, each country, it's up to each country to decide how they want to protect data, and as long as you're doing it in a particularly transparent and least trade restrictive way, you just go ahead and do your own thing, which would be one approach. Another approach, which would be sort of to parallel some of the other sort of global regulatory approaches which have been done in this area, would be to do things like mutual recognition agreements, which is a little bit like what the safe harbor agreements tend to be a bit like, where they sort of recognize each other's approaches as being equivalent and basically then allow for the free flow of data between those type of approaches. Another approach would be a global harmonization approach. So, for instance, the APEC approach, which is not binding, but, you know, Jake referred to as an attempt to get consensus around norms in this area. So there's sort of a variety of mechanisms, I think, at play here.
But, you know, I think to that point, just to what extent are we talking about, you know, sort of good faith, you know, divergent ideas about how should we do these things? And there's a kind of a logistical problem that's, you know, well, we need to hammer something out so that, you know, it works for people, versus are we really looking at, you know, divergences that are becoming entrenched for really protectionist reasons? I mean, obviously, you know, there's some of both always in the universe, but you know, what are we more talking about in this space?
I'll just say briefly, I mean, I think that there are some hard issues here. I think data privacy is one, there's national security, there's a range of issues. I think, though, another thing that we are seeing increasingly more of is, which I think is, you know, very directly applicable to this issue, is simply the type of interventions that governments are doing, which really are nothing much more than commercial restrictions. You know, in the which you know, to some extent, are a little bit like digital sort of infant industry policy, where you know, they're trying to develop their own Google or their own eBay or their own Amazon, and you know, not basically trying to avoid levels of competition over the internet, and so through various mechanisms, degrading, blocking access to these websites as they provide space domestically for these type of companies and entities to go up. Now, we know that, you know, in a very simple trade law perspective, you know, the norm of discrimination is that, you know, you are meant to treat basically the same goods and services, you know, the same from, you know, you treat your domestic companies the same as you treat goods coming from, you know, imported. And so even just applying that simple norm reveals the challenges that we have here, which is why, in a way, the norms that have been developed, I think, in the trade law context here are very applicable and would work quite well.
And I mean, I think you're right. It is a little bit of both. And, I mean, our pitch has been that we ought to try to develop rules among like-minded countries that see an open global digital marketplace as a good thing and hammer out these important issues on a good faith basis. And I think one example of that is the Trans-Pacific Partnership negotiations. I think Jonathan's right in that information is flowing back and forth and around the world right now. It's not that our borders are digital borders are closed. It's that we see trends from some of these from some actors in the world that are moving in the wrong direction and developing policies for economic or political reasons. And you know, it really doesn't matter to our businesses. The end result is the same, that your information is restricted. So I think TPP is a good example of, and as are the other trade agreements that are in the process of being negotiated or about to be negotiated, like the International Services Agreement, the US-EU partnership, as ways of sort of hammering out among like-minded countries good rules and codes of conduct in this area that will guarantee that information flows in the future. And I think what we're really worried about are policies in places like Vietnam and Indonesia, either, you know, which have proposed local server requirements, essentially, that you have to keep your data in local servers in the country in order to operate cloud services or other IT services. But there are others around the world. A number of countries are trying to develop national payment capabilities and so are restricting the flows of financial data. Other countries are restricting for political or other reasons in a way that is more trade restrictive than necessary. That, you know, you can block YouTube or Facebook for indefinitely. And that, like I said before, affects companies, all of our companies, including, you know, consumer product companies and business-to-business companies.
So also part of the challenge is understanding, when we're talking about good faith, mapping it to particular political values. So, for example, in December, there was a meeting of representatives of the International Telecommunications Union, the ITU, which is a UN-affiliated body. It actually predates the UN, to try to think about, should the ITU take responsibility for certain aspects of internet governance, particularly from a security perspective, because they felt that the organization that currently does it, ICANN, it's not a governmental organization. It's not truly representative. Now, people talked about a number of different values there. Some countries were very clear. They said, listen, we don't like a global internet. We want to have a more national control-based approach. Other countries said, well, we're worried about cybersecurity. We need a global body that thinks about this. And then you have sort of a more patriotic model. So a number of fairly senior European officials have made statements, and in fact, one country even proposed this as policy, saying, we're not going to work with any American cloud providers because of Patriot Act. Now, those of you who know the Patriot Act know that that's not the operative aspect of U.S. law that allows the American government to have access to certain types of data, but the Patriot Act is sort of code for, we generally don't trust those Americans, and sort of that models. And then you have countries that say, listen, all these standards that are out there were developed by Americans, and so why should we trust them? Shouldn't we develop our own standards? And by the way, that means that no one will compete with our market of a billion people because we're going to be the only ones who use our own standards. And trying to establish, well, good faith for what and why gets tricky.
Well, we've got some people from the government here. Why should they trust us?
Well, let me first say that all governments do have the sovereign rights to regulate activities in their borders, and no one is saying that the trade rules should trump that. I think what the trade rules can do is make the governments accountable for those measures that they put in place. I can give a small example. I was contacted by a software company who was getting blocked in, surprise, surprise, China. And it was essentially a collaboration tool, that allowed, the software to be developed among various locations. So a classic cloud, application, and it shows the brilliance of, you know, the internet allowing remotely located people working together for things of economic value. It couldn't for the life of me figure out why this is an application that could be, that should be blocked. And we did approach the Chinese government. The Chinese government, I think, saw reason, and it was probably on the same server with something that they found objectionable, but it ended up removing the block. So that was a case, I think, where they did not have, I think they would agree, a legitimate reason to block it, where we can agree to disagree on some of the other areas where they're also blocking. But at least they were held accountable in that case to not, in my view, impeding legitimate commerce. What we don't, that was, the trick here though was that was at their discretion. They had no, necessary obligation to listen to me and to take action when I was trying to help a particular, aggrieved company. So what we're trying to do is actually create a baseline rule that the data should be moving, across borders. Doesn't prevent governments from having exceptions, privacy, security, etc., but it has to be justified in light of the underlying obligation that the default is data should flow. And then the difficult question is, okay, how do you implement the various exceptions, and, you know, what standard of privacy, what standard of security, what public morals issue are legitimately inside or outside the scope of what you can do. Another example, everyone, you know, I negotiated a trade agreement which ended up not progressing with Thailand. One of their demands was, in the context of that negotiation, that we give particular credence to their desire to make sure that the monarchy was respected on the internet. We wrestled that, and we have all our First Amendment issues. Very difficult from a trade policy perspective to say that we will take down information that's not illegal under U.S. law. But the bottom line was, one of the responses, and this I think gets to the main point, is often a very blunt response. They'll just block completely an entire service. And I think the conversation that one wants to have based on a trade rule is, we can respect your local standards, your local values, your local laws. Is the action that you are proposing to solve it, is it really proportional? Is it really the necessary action to address your concern? In this case, there are techniques, and technology, again, here is very helpful to make sure that you can narrow down the scope to which the government actually impedes what's otherwise legitimate commerce. And the challenge is to have a framework that allows the conversation between governments to make sure that these trade impediments are minimized.
I just want to pick up just quickly on something Jonathan said before, which I think is one of the key issues here, which is the idea of maintaining a rational sort of framework when it comes to cross-border data flows, because, and maybe to link it back to the developing country perspective, because, you know, essentially what we're talking about here is a vehicle for economic growth. And certainly, Jake was talking about this a little bit in terms of what eBay is doing overseas, and I think this is what we're going to increasingly see, is that the opportunities to actually engage in the global trading system are going to be enormous, particularly for traders in developing countries. They're going to be able to use this as a platform to often overcome barriers like poor infrastructure, you know, inefficient custom procedures and the like, to actually link in a way that's just been impossible in the past. So in a sense, there's a very strong economic rationale to actually making sure that this happens and develops in a way which is, you know, essentially free of unnecessary barriers. So the argument, so in a sense, the trade rules, I think the strong argument there is this one, that in a sense, the long-term kind of growth benefits are there, and what you're trying to do is develop the type of disciplines which prevent sort of it being captured, in a sense, by particular interests in the process of it being developed.
And well, this is shifts gears a little bit, but Jake mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership, and I had a question for Stanford about this, which was when the president mentioned the Trans-Pacific Partnership in his State of the Union, and so you know, I had to do some coverage, and I thought I would quickly check you know, what my colleagues at Slate said about that. We had only one piece that had ever mentioned it, and it was I think someone rather alarmed said that the rules for intellectual property worldwide were being rewritten in secret somewhere over the Pacific Ocean. Is that how you see it? I'm guessing not.
Well, I'd be giving away the secret if I answered that.
No, smoke it out here.
There you go. No, I think we certainly approach IP rules in the Trans-Pacific Partnership as an extension of the kind of logic we've been talking about in other areas where, you know, if you flash back 50 or 60 years, we're talking about trade as moving goods across borders, and the evolution of international trade over the ensuing time has been an evolution of dealing more and more in depth with the kinds of issues that our goods and services confront when they get across the borders, and we're trying to do business in foreign markets, and particularly as countries like the United States are dealing more and more in value-added goods and services, we want to make sure that the vehicles for monetizing value-added in foreign markets are available in all the major systems where our companies are doing business. And if you think about how you monetize value added in a good or a service, it's often through intellectual property. It's often through a copyright protecting creativity, a patent protecting inventive value, or a trademark protecting reputational value associated with a good or service. So it is a very important function of a trade agreement to lend certainty to those things. That's not to say that there isn't a certain amount of alarm associated with the notion that that there will be trade rules in this space, and there's a certain there's a certain strain in public discourse around the internet that abhors any kind of restriction, even if it's a restriction for a property right that wouldn't bother us at all if we were talking about the same thing in the environment of physical property. And one of the things we've tried to do to respond to that in the context of the Trans-Pacific Partnership in particular is be very clear that even as we seek to define exclusive rights, that exclusive doesn't mean absolute, and that the rights in the copyright space that we're standing up for and think definitely need to be protected in the context of the TPP should also be subject to limitations and exceptions that are consistent with our own law and jurisprudence for things like criticism, comment, news reporting, teaching, scholarship, research. And I think the more we can do to make sure that the public understands that those are functions that we respect, and that we ultimately seek for our Trans-Pacific Partnerships to seek to achieve an appropriate balance in their systems, including on those kinds of issues, the more space we have potentially for others to also respect the fact that people who enter into into digital commerce with intellectual property that they want to see protected do have rights that ought to be respected there.
All right. You know, I wonder if we can get some spice going here. You know, maybe if Alan or Joshua would have an example of perhaps an area where you think that the United States is sort of the one trying to keep foreign elements out or not willing to, you know, let information kind of flow and let foreign companies gain access here.
You know, we can keep talking about I don't know quite as much about TPP, but certainly one of the bigger questions that was quite controversial was the idea that this was a trade negotiation that was happening without pretty much transparency at all. Also, we saw the same thing with the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, the ACTA, which, you know, through a series of progressive leaks became less and less popular until European Parliament was basically forced to reject it. And I think that's been one of the challenges from a political aspect, something that we've learned from the Guardian newspaper's sorting of WikiLeaks documents is that copyright bills in New Zealand and Spain were basically bludgeoned through from strong industrial influence, primarily rooted in America. When that broke in Spain, it caused a small scandal. It was eventually, I believe, overturned. And so the challenge is, again, I completely agree that there are very legitimate industrial concerns, and you can't have an information economy without intellectual property. The challenge is, how do we do this in a transparent, democratic fashion?
So, yeah, just a quick comment on that. I think it's an important the issue of how we both do deals in the international trade space and engage effectively with public and stakeholders who are interested in how those deals are taking shape is one that we're very seized of inside the administration. We've done a tremendous amount in the context of TPP to kind of facilitate that kind of engagement. That's not to say that there aren't still challenges, but if you go to a round of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, you see a degree of stakeholder engagement and communication and accessibility of the negotiators that has never been present in any previous trade negotiation that I've been affiliated with. In terms of the importance of our advocacy with foreign governments, I think the democratically elected governments of New Zealand and Spain would probably take exception to the notion that, you know, anything they did was at the behest of the United States. And the laws that resulted from the processes in both of those countries actually happen to include significant elements, each of them, that are quite different from U.S. law in rather innovative ways, trying to tackle a generation of the online piracy problem that in some ways goes beyond the online piracy problem that we were attacking in the United States with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So I think it's a good thing from the U.S. perspective that those and other governments are trying to be at the forefront of tackling problems like this. It's something it's something we do want to encourage in a way that's consistent with our own law and our own values, and having rule of law in the internet space is certainly something that's entirely consistent with those values.
I heard the question actually a little bit differently, so I'll answer what I heard, which was, you know, to the extent the U.S. is itself imposing restrictions on the internet, and I guess make the short point, because I certainly don't want this to be a conversation simply about other countries' restrictions, and it really probably just gets to the broader point that, you know, this is going to have to be about finding ways of balancing appropriate intervention with actually allowing data to flow freely. But I certainly think if you look at, I think one, because there's an interesting way of thinking about it. Again, if we get back to the privacy issue, I think you know, there's different countries have got actually very different, like, first principle conceptions of privacy. And, you know, in the US, it's sort of an amalgam of constitutional rights and statutory-based laws. And, you know, in some respects, you know, these differences are going to create their own barriers. But at the same time, the way that governments regulate also has the potential to increase confidence in the ability of both consumers and businesses to actually use the internet as a commercial platform. I mean, the willingness of someone to put their personal data online, I think, is going to some extent depend on whether you think actually it's ever going to get out, how companies and businesses and governments are going to use it. So, you know, the idea that, you know, regulation, an appropriate level of regulation here actually is going to be certainly, I think, important to actually maintaining the confidence in it. So these issues are actually going to cut both ways in some respects.
I think it might be time to turn to see if there's any questions out there in the audience. People, you know, bother to show up on a chilly, rainy day, possibly have some things to say to ask our panel. I believe we have some people with microphones, maybe. Yes, this gentleman here.
I'm Bob Hershey. I'm a consultant to what extent are you able to hold meetings over the internet and negotiate some of the kinds of things that we've heard about today?
So I'll say from a government perspective, it's a lot. I'm sure a lot of you experience this in the private sector that we're doing a lot more digital video conferencing than was the case a few years ago. And the current budgetary climate puts a premium on making the most of all your taxpayer dollars in terms of how the government engages internationally. So we do a lot of that kind of work through DVCs. There are downsides to that. There's the lack of the face-to-face interaction. There's the lack of the ability to sort of pause, go in the next room, have a one-on-one conversation, come back, and all that is important to getting deals done. So it can't substitute for the face-to-face old-fashioned interactions that we need to get done, and it has drawbacks. Security is a big drawback in some of these in some of the technologies available for online conferencing. Maybe Alan can tell us how to improve on that, but it is an important supplement to face-to-face negotiations.
You know, I was glad that security came up sort of incidentally there, because I imagine, you know, this is a big issue here. Governments are obviously going to want, as they use digital technology and information technology more and more themselves, they're going to want to have some assurance of its security. But that's obviously going to, you know, raise a lot of questions in terms of who do you procure from, who do you contract with, what do companies do with information, how does it flow within there? And it seems like just a sort of a playpen for both very legitimate concerns, but also for all kinds of, you know, possible monkey business.
The last major cybersecurity legislation was actually the Federal Information Security Management Act of 2002. And that's really just sort of how dated government security regulations are. And again, this is one of those policies that started out, the text of the law is quite parsimonious. It says, listen, identify your risks, tell us how you're addressing them. The problem is it was implemented through regulation in a very long roundabout model of compliance checkboxes. Until 2006, you couldn't comply with this law electronically. This is a law where agencies measured their compliance in binder feet. So we're slowly getting better at that. Certainly entrepreneurial agencies have found ways to sort of say, listen, we're under attack. We need to secure our own systems. If anything, the challenge from the U.S. government is on, as you mentioned, the procurement side. That's probably a whole nother panel about how we overhaul IT procurement for flexible situations. But I think the security side is less of a challenge because we can't use the latest cutting-edge technologies. And in the international front, this is something that countries have identified. They're saying, listen, there's all this stuff that is being sold to us by Westerners. We don't trust it. Famous scandal in Greece in 2005 where the main switches that the primary Greek cell phone service were using, giant heavy steel switches, were sold to them. They were sold as compliant with American law enforcement policy to allow a government to install backdoor wiretaps. The Greek phone company didn't pay for them, so they weren't turned on. But someone figured out how to turn them on, and we still don't know who. What we do know is that someone was eavesdropping on senior Greek government officials for about 18 months in 2005. So this is a challenge around the world that we have to solve.
I just might add to Alan's comment, because it seems to me also that the national security dimension, I think, he's going to be particularly challenging. Because if you think about it in the more conventional goods and services context, and again, I'll refer back to the trading world, I mean, there's national security exceptions in the WTO, and in a sense, it's more or less where the rule of law tends to end and governments tend to do what they need to do. But you could sort of cabinet off in the sense because, the WTO, the GATT was sort of dealing in a world where you really might have to take trade restrictions essentially in times of war to deal with UN Security Council issues. It was a lot more sort of clear cut, whereas here in a slightly more amorphous world where the national security implications of being connected globally are a lot more significant. I mean, we've had the issue which has come out recently about Chinese attacks, cyber security issues in the United States, but the point really is that, you know, key, say, for instance, infrastructure, and then it becomes strategic industries that just start to get designated as being part of national security. So the capacity for this exception, in a sense, to really bleed wide, I think, is real here. And I don't have an answer to how you respond to that, but I think, I mean, some colleagues here have done some work around this in a very specific context dealing with China, but I think one of the ideas there is that what we really need to be focusing on here, as much as the rule of law, is actually developing norms of conduct where you actually develop understandings about appropriate ways of actually using the internet, which might be one way of getting at the issue.
Sorry. questions? Yeah, Matt?
Thank you. Could you tell us a little bit about tax regulation and how that interferes or enhances internet trade?
Taxes. Anyone? Yeah, go for it.
The only thing on my mind is the e-commerce moratorium at the World Trade Organization. And so that was a provision that was adopted at the beginning of the foundation of the World Trade Organization back in the 1990s. And it's been extended by unanimous consent ever since. And so it still remains in effect today, but it's subject to the sort of unanimous consent every 2 years when everyone gets together in Geneva or somewhere else and has a meeting. What we've proposed, this has been on my mind because we just submitted comments for the International Services Agreement, is to extend and make permanent the sort of internet customs duties moratorium through the International Services Agreement. So just institutionalize it instead of having it be subject to kind of the whims of the membership.
So inside the United States, the big question is how do we handle state and local sales taxes? And it's interesting to see sort of coalitions sort of continue to evolve. There are lots of people who say, listen, particularly the online vendors don't want to pay sales tax, and the large brick-and-mortar vendors want sales tax to be imposed. What's fascinating is there was a statement today from Grover Norquist, who's a famous anti-tax advocate, who said the SOPA and PIPA thing means that the internet won't stand for a sales tax online. So this is, you know, one of the classic old guard DC establishment activists sort of trying to draft this new internet activist community in one of his fights. So it'll be very interesting to see how that plays out.
Yes, Jake was mentioning the WTO moratorium. So in the trade agreements, we actually turn that into a binding commitment. So at the border, from a tariff perspective, we commit not to put a tariff on digital products transiting into the country. That's a border issue. Maybe you were asking what happens, and I think that's what Alan was more focused on. It is an issue. Well, it's not an issue in that the trade rules generally don't speak to taxation. That's considered a domestic issue as long as the taxes aren't discriminatory. Right? You don't tax a foreign good more than you tax a domestic good. Where we are seeing this come into a little bit of an issue that's related to this data flow issue is governments are saying, I want to tax the activity, and I can only tax the activity if the company establishes in my jurisdiction. So essentially it's a challenge to the whole idea of allowing for cross-border trade when governments conclude that the only way they can get their piece of what they think is legitimately taxable income is to force the company to establish in country. So we don't take a view on whether governments have a right to tax or not tax. They do, as long as it's not discriminatory. We do take a view on whether you should force companies to establish, and that being the reason. It's not, from our perspective, a legitimate reason. Yes, they should have a right to exercise their taxation authority. No, they shouldn't force companies to establish in order to accomplish that.
Good stuff. Yes, you, sir?
Hello. This is Adam Bisuti from Inside U.S. Trade. I just had two questions related to IPR and data flows related to TPP, and in the context of a round coming up next week in Singapore. kind of status on these issues. On IPR, I guess this is more for Stan. You know, in terms of IPR, and this is a bit unrelated, I guess, to the issue of you know, internet copyrights and things, but is there a sense that USTR will be verbalizing new ideas on its patent proposal, and to what extent are these changes being considered? To what extent is the initial proposal going to be changed? And then on data flow,
on its what proposal?
On the patent pharmaceutical proposal, the access to medicines proposal. And then on data flows, Jonathan, what is the progress on this issue? How are you going about the work of determining exceptions and, you know, for privacy and security? What is sort of the dynamic of the debate now, and what do you expect, what kind of progress do you expect here in the next round?
Okay.
So I think pharmaceutical patents is off topic, so I'm going to pass it to Jonathan on the data flow.
We have a proposal on the table, a lot of engagement. All the issues we're talking about here on governments wanting to make sure that they don't lose regulatory jurisdiction are a subject of conversation. We'll see. I mean, it's a negotiation, so it's not over till it's over. But there is broad-based engagement and recognition that this is clearly a relevant topic if you're having a modern trade agreement.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. Maria Madrano with ITI. Congratulations to Jonathan for all his work on getting cross-border data flows into the TPP and maybe even the ISA soon. What about the countries that aren't covered by the TPP and the ISA? Are there any thoughts either from the Brookings perspective or the U.S. government perspective on how to socialize this free flow of information with countries like Brazil, Indonesia, China, India, maybe? Is there a Brookings roadshow planned or U.S. government bilateral dialogues? That any ideas, just thoughts on that?
I'm definitely up for moderating in Brazil, you know, if anyone.
Yeah, likewise. Count at Rio, Carnival next year.
Right, let's do it.
No, I think it's a good point. I mean, I do get at this briefly in the paper because I think there's two parts to that. I think one is that, you know, there are these forums, the TPP, there's going to be the transatlantic opportunity. Obviously, the Japan might join the TPP. Japan's negotiating with the EU. But this is a context where formal trade rules are being negotiated. I think it's also important to use other forums to develop more sort of informal, less binding norms around this. And there's, I think, a lot of opportunities to do that. For instance, you know, APEC's one opportunity. I think the G20 is possibly another one. And just bilaterally, I mean, we see this is already happening. There are, you know, different countries have actually reached sort of essentially some principles around these issues, and so there's scope to sort of do that. So I think it's a combination of both. But I do think the thrust of your conversation question is the right one, which is the idea that this really is a conversation that needs to be broadened out.
Further thoughts? Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I can just follow up. The one vehicle we have, and we obviously have resource constraints. You can only manage so many negotiations at the same time. But we do have, as Josh was mentioning, a non-binding vehicle, which is the ICT trade principles, which do speak to some of these issues. And we are actively trying to have other countries sign up with us. We're working on Jordan, on Morocco, on Taiwan, on ASEAN. So to the extent that we have engagement with various countries that we think share our view and are willing to put this into, eventually, we hope, into a binding context, that's the one vehicle we do have.
I also think, I mean, it's important to use the countries that are already part of these conversations or who get it to talk to others. And so, I mean, if you see what's going on, I think Chile generally gets this. And so they're part of the TPP negotiations. They're part of a number of other trade agreements. And they've got programs like Startup Chile where they bring entrepreneurs into Chile to try to encourage them to start up businesses in the country. And so I think, you know, at a high level, they understand the importance of the issues that we're talking about up here. And so to find forums like APEC, like in Geneva, using the e-commerce work program, to get them to tell their stories. You know, Turkey's been helpful in bringing technology into the classroom. You know, Pakistan benefits or has an entrepreneurial community that benefits from e-commerce and information flows. And so to bring these countries in to talk to others that may be a little bit more reticent is helpful. And I also think, I mean, there's good stories in the United States, and we represent big companies, it may not warm your heart to know that they benefit from e-commerce and information flows, but we go around the country as well and talk with small businesses and educators about how they interact with the global marketplace. We met with a company, I think, in Detroit called Fluxtrol, which makes induction heating equipment. So they put sort of coverings on metals that direct heat to specific places, and so it saves on heating costs for manufacturing. And they have a YouTube channel. And so the way that they've explained their business and the way that they've developed relationships with potential customers overseas is through YouTube. And so they're a big exporter into China. That's a portion of their business, mostly because of technology. I've got a suit at home from a company called Black Lapel. And it's two guys who used to work on Wall Street up in New York. And they decided that was too soul-crushing for them. And so they decided to start an online custom suiting business. Suit retails for about $400, and they export to 66 countries. They have 10 employees, around 10 employees, in New York City. And so there are great stories to tell that don't involve big companies, both here and abroad. And I think that's an important part of the conversation.
Absolutely. Went out there? No? Yeah.
Hi, Meredith Gilston with the Washington Tariff and Trade Letter. I find it interesting what Matt said about the, civil society organizations not satisfied with the level of transparency, especially in the TPP, but also in other negotiations. And Mr. McCoy, you've said that it was as transparent as any previous trade negotiations, and your boss, Ambassador Kirk, has said the similar. Is there any way for both sides to be satisfied here, or is there, like, both sides, not that... I know that you've said also that civil society organizations are not one of the sides of the negotiations, but in terms of public opinion and public press around this. Thanks.
Yeah, working on trade agreements makes one acutely aware that you can't satisfy all the people all the time. There's a continuing role and obligation of the government to listen to all the diverse viewpoints that are out there on these issues, to bear in mind the economic interests of the United States and implement the policies of the president in this area, and that's what we try very hard to do. And those policies are informed by a desire to balance a really wide range of views and benefits. So I don't despair of the possibility of developing balanced policy, and that's what we constantly seek to develop and implement. But one of the interesting realities of doing international trade in the internet context is instant communication also means instant criticism, and we hear that, we internalize it, we try to move forward in as balanced a way as possible.
I mean, first of all, I think the USTR has done a really good job in terms of outreach and transparency. And I think we are, having been to some of these rounds, that's clear. I mean, they actually listen to people. They hold forums. And I think they do a good job balancing. I mean, the reality is that you can't negotiate in public. And they shouldn't be asked to. And so for some people, there will never be enough transparency, and that's okay. But I do think that they do an effective job. I also, on the intellectual property rights question, I think it's important to acknowledge that there are concerns in the digital age, and that some intellectual property rights challenges have become more acute or require action like we take in trade agreements, precisely because of the challenges of the digital age. And so I mentioned trade secret theft before. I think it's important to have the right rules and frameworks, including the balance of rights and the balance of rights and limitations and exceptions in U.S. law, that protect intellectual property rights, but also allow the digital economy to function. Because if you don't have the former, no one's going to be confident enough to engage in the latter.
I think that I saw a hand back there. Yes.
Thanks. Excuse me. Two questions. First is, I'm curious if there's any reaction to the WTO decision about the online gambling services. And the second is, we were talking about taxes, but I'd like to broaden this out to, there's a bit of an uproar in Europe over, and the poster children here are Starbucks and Amazon and Google, for pretty aggressive use of transfer pricing guidelines to reduce their profits in those countries. Have the incentives gone too far?
Well, gambling, can anyone speak to that?
Yeah, I can probably speak to that a little bit, just to say that for those who don't know what we're talking about here, there has been a long-running World Trade Organization dispute between the United States and a Caribbean nation, Antigua and Barbuda, about the ability to offer gambling services, online gambling services into the United States. It has to do with the U.S. GATS schedule and commitments in the services area, and that case has been litigated. The government of Antigua has announced its intention now to move forward with suspension of WTO concessions over the results of that dispute, and their plans involve something called cross retaliation, where they would not retaliate in sector, in the services sector, but they would suspend concessions in another area. In this case, they've talked about intellectual property, and as with many disputes, the governments keep talking to each other even as the process moves forward, and that's certainly true in this case. We're engaged in ongoing discussions with the government of Antigua and Barbuda on that matter, and we're hopeful that we can work in good faith to find a way forward.
So it's funny, we were chatting about this earlier, and I'm very much not an expert on the international trade side, but I've done a lot of work on the online gaming aspect, and I think the one hope is just that if the U.S. can run out the clock, as it has succeeded doing in a fashion that makes me despair if the U.S. is ever on the wrong end of a trade agreement, just how long an actor can delay retaliation. But there are a number of policies going on in the United States to allow certain state control, which introduces a host of challenges domestically, but would allow, if someone conforms to, for example, Nevada's new policies or New Jersey's policies, they could enter that market in a way that might meet with WTO policy. And I just want to get back to this challenge on intellectual property. I will say it is heartening to see the administration focus intellectual property on trade secret theft, because for a while many of us were very concerned that they were perhaps not giving that. It was getting short shrift for other aspects of intellectual property. So I would like to commend the administration for really beginning to make that a priority when perhaps they spend a little too long focusing on some of the other aspects.
Maybe I could say a quick word on trade secret theft, please. Which is that, you know, it is true the administration has announced an enhanced focus on that issue. We had an event last Wednesday where we rolled out a new administration strategy on trade secret theft, and I think Alan's comment is a good reflection of how it's been received in the technology community. And the only observation I wanted to make is that this is tied into the subject we're talking about today, because it's not like trade secrets haven't existed and been important for generations. They've certainly been there, but trade secret existed as a very quiet, frequently unnoticed intellectual property right that mainly came up in a sort of a personnel context when, you know, big companies were writing contracts with their personnel and worried about them leaving and taking secret technology to a competitor. And now the networked environment has created all these possibilities for cyber intrusions where someone might be able to just, as we've read in the press recently, invade corporate networks and take secret information that exists there and then apply it to their own commercial purposes. And this is a danger that we've become highly sensitized to in the U.S. government, and it calls on us to go back and dust off these disciplines around trade secret protection that were written in a different era and make sure that they are relevant and meaningfully applied and meaningfully monitored in the context of the present day challenges that we have, and that's something the administration is certainly working very hard to do, both at home and with our partners overseas.
I was reading through the administration's trade secret policy, and they used all these examples of different companies that have had their trade secrets stolen, and I think the first five were members of NFTC, and so this is important to us. I mean, I think to your point about new rules, my understanding is that a number of countries don't protect trade secrets except through contracts, and so unless you have a contract with a bad actor that is stealing your trade secrets, you're kind of SOL. And that's, I mean, to your point, it's not just the employee that is taking a document in his pocket and leaving and going to give it to another company. As reported in the press, it seems like this is a lot more state-sponsored, and really that gets at sort of the commercial heart of our economy.
Indeed. Yes?
Liz Nightingale with Baker McKenzie. And one comment and one question. I wanted to echo what Jake said about it being a very transparent process. I've been at two of the stakeholder negotiation sessions and numerous preparatory meetings and debrief sessions, and so I wanted to commend USTR for that. The question is for Jonathan, and it's with respect to the ICT trade principles. You had mentioned Taiwan is one of the countries with whom you're setting up some principles, and I'm wondering if that is going to be folded into or done separately from the upcoming U.S.-Taiwan discussions as part of the TIFA in next month.
It is in that context. We always look for some action-forcing events to give it some focus if we can actually conclude it. I have no idea whether we'll get there, but hopefully that bilateral engagement will be a good venue to highlight an area where it looks like Taiwan and us do have general agreement on these important principles.
You know, I wonder if I could ask a little bit more about the gaming case, if only because it's a sort of an interesting concrete illustration, not so much in terms of the countermeasures that Antigua was asking for, but, you know, here you have a situation where gambling is generally illegal in the United States. It's easy to see. We see these internet gaming bans as, you know, really about sort of domestic morals regulation, a certain kind of paternalistic rule. At the same time, you know, anyone who lives in the area probably saw all the ads about the gambling proposition in Maryland during the last election cycle. And, you know, the overwhelming majority of the money going to sort of block the construction of the new casino was coming from the owners of the existing casino in West Virginia. It's a very classic Baptist and bootleggers kind of dynamic here. And so, you know, from another viewpoint, sort of efforts against internet gaming in the United States are just the very essence of the kind of rent seeking that, you know, trade agreements are supposed to get rid of, that here we have these sort of inefficient producers of gaming services located in the United States. You have a whole wide world that kind of wants to knock the doors down. And so, you know, not to get anyone to speak out of school, but maybe Joshua can say something about this. I mean, how do you say to a country, you know, I mean, how do you draw the lines here? Because each country does have its own sort of little quirks and different, you know, industrial structures and political economies to them.
I don't want to get too much into the sort of weeds of the gambling case,
of course.
But I mean, there's two sort of, I think, issues which really came out of it, and which your question goes to, because the challenge for the U.S. is, you know, I guess from first principles, really, the question is, you know, to what extent do countries, when they enter into these type of trade commitments, open up their markets to imports? And it's a decision each country makes. It's a variety of sort of influences that lead to that decision. And then there's the other question of how do you actually, in a sense, implement that decision? And that, it's at that point, I think, that the United States got tripped up in this case, mm-hmm. where, you know, I think actually on a fair reading of the GATT schedule, that there was an intention not to open it up, but the judicial system at the WTO, you know, read it in a different way, which is sort of where the problem lies. So I think one of the key messages for that is that, in a sense, how you schedule your commitments actually really matters.
Right. Fair enough.
So, again, I apologize for only being able to speak to you. I feel so provincial, I can only speak to the American case. I think it's good. The it's interesting as a microcosm for all of these issues that we've talked about, where you took an issue that not just had traditional, economic boundaries, but moral boundaries and, most important, governance boundaries. And now we've opened it up to sort of the internet and said, okay, well, who's going to be in charge? When we're worried about issues such as collecting taxes, such as consumer protection against problem gambling, and perhaps most important, regulation. So something that has allowed legalized gaming to survive where it has in the United States is very strong government oversight. And, you know, whether it's state lotteries or riverboat gambling, and certainly Nevada has incredibly strong controls. And so the question is, as we open this up on the internet, how do we sort of do consumer protection? How do we do brand protection? If you have a brand that, you know, one bad brand can spoil it for everyone, as we found out one of the Costa Rica-based poker communities, it turns out they were dipping into some of their players' winnings, and there was all sorts of internal accounting issues, which, you know, the industry itself recognized was a problem. So as we begin to open up in any of these issues, we need some sort of protection. And we see this, you know, in healthcare, in markets, in financial markets. Some governance structure is needed to preserve trust for everything to work. And ultimately, any decision in any of these issues we come down to talking about will boil down to a governance process for establishing trust.
Seems fair enough.
Yeah, if I could just pick up on that. I think that is sort of the heart of the good outcome that's come out of the APEC privacy framework, where in order to establish trust, the governments get together, set some baseline requirements, and they agree to mutually enforce against an agreed upon set of standards. The challenge is in areas where you can't come up with that mutually agreed set of standards. So whether it's in the security side, whether it's on morals, if you can't come up with that, it's very hard to have sort of a transnational sort of multi-stakeholder process. But it's clearly going to be the requirement for this sector to thrive, to have those type of transnational enforcement cooperation and policy, I don't know about if it's harmonization, but at least some, I guess the code word is interoperability between different regimes, so that you can have a mechanism for the trade to flow and yet to have the trust there that has some enforcement behind it.
And I think, as we said, in the Thailand context, try to find ways to at least narrow the scope of the areas where you can't reach that sort of mutualism. Is there any final question? Concluding thoughts?
I just want to tie this back to the top of the question of strategic data theft. And I think it gets down to this idea of shared negotiations. So, you know, China has been bandied about. We were talking about China, new Cold War, and taming the cyber dragon. I think focusing on China doesn't help trade negotiation process at all. But more importantly, it's important to acknowledge that this is happening from around the world. You know, you can rattle off, you know, Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Israel, Russia, Brazil. It's very easy to find examples where you've seen cyber theft of trade secrets. The challenge is, and again, if you have a model where you can't prevent all of it, moving to an environment where you have these norms that said, listen, this isn't how we do business in a global society, and comes down to that approach.
All right. I think we've about reached our appointed time here. So let me thank everyone for coming out and thank our panel for their wonderful discussion.